You are listening to Covenant Eyes Radio, helping you in your journey to stay pure online. Today, Luke will be interviewing Dr. Mark Laser of Faithful and True Ministries. Dr. Laser is a pioneer in the field of sex addiction. Today, Luke will talk to him about why he began Faithful and True and the story of his own sexual sin. Dr. Laser will speak at length about the term sexual addiction and why it is gaining more recognition in the medical community.
Everything about the human sexual response is controlled in the brain, and the way the brain processes sexual thought and sexual activity is through the neurological or neurochemical connections in the brain. We're dealing with substances in the brain that are as powerful, I think, as cocaine or heroin.
Dr. Laser will also talk about the prevalence of pornography struggles in the church today and give pastors practical steps they can take in their churches to bring this issue into the light.
The truth of it is that we have an epidemic, really a worldwide epidemic of pornography problems that we have.
Well, Mark, what events in your life moved you into this line of work, writing and talking and speaking about sexual addiction?
Well, the main event happened back in 1987, Luke, where I got intervened on by a group of people who had found out about my own sexual sin. And, you know, at that point, I had been for over 25 years looking at pornography and, also involved in, masturbation and then other forms of sexual encounters. And so, you know, you can only keep those kind of secrets so long, I think. And
right.
It became known to some of my colleagues, and they sat me down in a room one afternoon and told me what they knew, and that I was fired from, you know, every job that I had. And there happened to be a recovering alcoholic in the room who was familiar enough with the wider field of addiction to have understood that some of the problems was having may be, in fact, an addiction. So he walked over to my chair as I sat there slumped and broken, and he said, I think your sins with sex are no different than mine with alcohol. And he had heard of a treatment center that had just recently opened up in the Minneapolis area to treat the sexual addiction. And so he found out more information about that. The next thing I knew, I was having an interview with that hospital. And the next thing I knew, I was on a plane to go to that treatment center. And that was March 17th of 1987. And that's my sobriety birthday. And that's, you know, when I got involved in the field. And God has been, you know, leading me in some really interesting ways ever since. So the reason that we have the ministry that we do, my wife and I, is because, we ourselves are the survivors in our marriage of my infidelity and my sexual addiction. And we hope that, through our work, we can reach out to others and, you know, offer them the hope that you can become sober, you can become pure, you can transform and your marriage, and then also not just survive, but thrive, we think.
Now, you're among probably some of the first Christian researchers in the subject of sexual addiction, and your book, Healing the Wounds of Sexual Addiction, is really kind of a first of its kind. And as you know, the term sexual addiction is gaining more and more recognition among psychologists today and among counselors. But what are the reasons, do you think, for hesitancy to embrace the term sexual addiction?
Well, I think the main reason for that, Luke, is that the medical field, to some extent, the psychology field, to some extent, has thought that for something to be an addiction, it has to create neurochemical tolerance in the brain. In other words, the brain needs to adjust to whatever substance you put into it. So an alcoholic or a drug addict or a smoker or a caffeine addict, for that matter, you know, knows that, you know, over time, they're going to need more of their substance to achieve the same effect. So the scientific community said, you know, how does a behavior like sexuality or an eating disorder, for that matter, I mean, how does it, you know, produce the same level of neurochemical tolerance? Well, I think the answer is fairly simple, really, when you think about the fact that everything about the human sexual response is controlled in the brain, and the way the brain processes sexual thought and sexual activity is through the neurological or neurochemical connections, you know, in the brain. And so when we think about sex, even just fantasize about it, you know, there are very powerful neurochemicals in the brain that are created, like adrenaline and dopamine and serotonin and those kinds of neurochemical substances that everybody knows about. And, you know, those chemicals, when they're released in the brain or, you know, created in the brain, they create a sense of a high, an ecstasy, the same way that cocaine does. And then there's a whole other set of neurochemicals when you get touched and, you know, skin to skin. And then there's finally a set of neurochemicals that are released in the pleasure center of the brain when you actually have sexual release or an orgasm. So on the front end, you know, the excitation phase or the back end, the pleasure phase of sexuality, we're dealing with substances in the brain that are as powerful, I think, as cocaine or heroin. The truth of it is, as far as I'm concerned, from what I can tell in all of my experience and certainly my own life as well, is that a sex addict over time is going to need more of those same neurochemical substances to achieve the same effect. So you're going to need more fantasy, more masturbation, more pornography, more activity of whatever kind you're engaged in. You're going to need more of that to achieve the same effect. So as far as the field is concerned, you know, we believe that we meet the medical criteria for what an addiction is all about. You just have to kind of look at it in terms of the neurochemistry of the brain.
Okay. Well, and I often get the impression that the term addiction is, just in general, not just sex addiction or alcohol addiction or whatever, but that the term addiction overall is a very elastic, can also be an ambiguous term, especially in the culture. And so when you ask Christians if they feel addicted to, say, pornography,
right,
you tend to get higher percentages than when you ask researchers and therapists the same questions about what they think are the percentages of people who are addicted to pornography or addicted to sex. Why do you think there can be such a huge discrepancy, or discrepancy in the numbers and how people understand their own experience with pornography and the idea of being addicted to it?
Well, you know, I think one of the answers or one of the factors that's involved in all of this conversation about the prevalence of addiction is that one has only to realize that addicts are generally liars. I mean, we are so anxious about, you know, what other people are going to think about us and about our behaviors, you know, that over the years we've become, you know, exceptionally good liars. And also that, you know, the word that's very well known in the addiction field, denial. A lot of addicts are in denial. They're liars. They're deceivers. So, you know, trying to research the prevalence of an addiction is going to be really, really hard.
Sure.
A lot of people are into cover-up about who they are and what they're doing. So that's to a certain degree, I think that's why you're going to see such a discrepancy in terms of, you know, what is the prevalence of, like right now, what is the prevalence of, you know, men within the Christian community that are struggling at some level with internet pornography? You know, what is that figure? Well, you're going to hear figures everywhere from a third to two-thirds kind of thrown around. And the truth of it is, you know, whenever I talk about prevalence out there, you know, in the world, I think it's really safe to say that there's hardly anybody today that has not seen pornography on the internet, because it's so prevalent and it's so accidental sometimes. I mean, if you don't have some great filtering software or accountability software in your computer, I mean, it's just going to come up. And the truth of it is that the average Christian man out there, I think, they've all seen pornography. You know, what percentage of those guys that have actually seen it, do they then struggle with it? And I think it's safe to say that probably half of all Christian men, at some point in their life at least, or currently, are struggling with it. And I think it's safe to say that, you know, a certain percentage, maybe half of that half, are at a point where they're addicted, which it basically means they're looking at internet pornography, even though there's a part of them that doesn't want to be. The truth also is, I think, that with women, there's only been a couple of studies, the Nielsen ratings in terms of, you know, who is using internet pornography, and then also Today's Christian Women did a survey. I think the truth of it is that a third of all Christian women have intentionally gone to an internet pornography site to look at something. So, I mean, now, again, what is the percentage of those women who are, in fact, in the addict category? You know, it's just really hard to research because, again, nobody's being honest, I think, fully in terms of what that number would actually be. The truth of it is that, you know, we have an epidemic, and somebody even the other day when I was talking to them used the word pandemic. You know, it's it's really a worldwide epidemic of pornography problems that we have.
Yeah, not only is it tough to do surveys and do research on that, but as you're saying, even some of the terms that we use or some of the ways we talk about it can be a little bit ambiguous. I remember a survey that was done, a very broad survey done across American universities, done by Michael Leahy when he was doing, and he published it in his book, Porn University. And right. In that survey, something like, I think it was around 42% of the men surveyed said that the word was regularly visit sexually explicit websites or chat rooms.
Sure.
And then in the same survey, though, 64% of men said that they spend at least some time every week online for sexual purposes. So you have 42% who say it's fairly regular in their life and 64% who say that each week they're looking at it. Now, I would think a weekly viewing of pornography would be considered regular, but for some of these men, they just didn't read it that way. That wasn't how they read it. It's not regular. And then about 19% of the men said they feel controlled by their sexual desires or fantasies. So even though 64% of them said, I look at it every week, only 19% of them said, and I feel controlled by this. And so there, you know, just the terminology that's used really challenges our understanding of, okay, what is addiction? Is this truly an addiction? Is this something that's just something I'm dabbling with? Or is just something recreational for some guys? And this was across the board. This wasn't just Christian men. This was men in general. And so do you feel, given some of these things, that the word addiction is something we should be using?
Well, I do think that we do have a problem with language, just as, you know, as you're outlining there. I mean, it is somewhat a matter of interpretation, and I do also think that, you know, a lot of Christian men and women, you know, have an inherent problem with the word addiction. I mean, they just don't understand it at, you know, a clinical or medical level, and there are those people out there that think that using the term addiction is providing a person with an excuse for, you know, why they're doing their behavior and absolves them of responsibility for their decisions. I do think that those of us that are involved in the addiction field, I mean, it's one of my missions in life to, you know, educate the church about, you know, what does it mean? You know, you were using the term there, to be controlled by. I think that's a kind of a great description. I think a lot of addicts feel like they are controlled by their lust and their sexual desire. But what does that in fact mean in terms of our original sin nature? I mean, I tend to look at it theologically and say that, you know, since the fall of humankind, you know, we've all been prone to inherit, you know, original sin. So what does that mean? Well, to me, it means a certain level of pride, alienation, and rebellion from God. So an addict, when they say they're controlled, or, you know, another word we use all the time is that it's unmanageable or I feel powerless, it's really the same feeling that Paul was talking to us about when he said that the good that I would, I don't do, the evil that I hate, that is what I do. What a wretched, what an evil man am I. But basically he's talking about an inability, or Paul is talking about an inability to completely surrender our life to Christ. And I think your average addict is out of control or feeling controlled by because they haven't fully given up or let go of their need, their friendship, if you will, you know, with pornography and sexual thoughts. So I think basically when you say you're an addict or controlled by something, you're basically saying, I'm participating in original sin and I haven't fully surrendered, you know, in this case, my sexuality to God. I'm still holding on to that. I've surrendered my life to Christ, but I'm still holding on to my sexuality, which is the double-mindedness in the first chapter of the book of James.
I do see in the church much more willingness today to talk about the subject of pornography, probably more than ever before. What are the things that pastors of churches and leaders of ministries can do to help those hidden members in their midst who are struggling with these things on some level and need help, or they need the support of the church in order to bring those things out into the light, to confess them, and then to seek the help that they need?
First of all, you're right in that, you know, I've been involved in the field now for over 20 years, and it does seem like in this century now we've had a lot more examples of church leaders talking about this, even from the pulpit. And even there's been some courageous examples of pastors who have been able to share their own struggles, you know, with pornography and so forth. You know, that can be done, I think, as long as the pastor is able to also say, I once was lost in it. Now I've kind of found a way of controlling those desires. But I do think that that's a very important piece for pastors to be able to do. Now, if a pastor is not willing to tell his own story or doesn't really have his own story, then I do think that, you know, I've also seen lots of examples of where men from the church have been willing to come forward and, you know, in what we sometimes call a faith story or faith journey, personal testimony in church. You know, I've seen a lot of examples of men and in several cases women who have been willing to talk about how they've been lost in a world of sexual sin. So in other words, what I'm saying, Luke, is I think that it's always been the case that if we're able to have a testimony or we're able to have people that are willing to share their story, that always brings out other people who have that story. It helps them to feel safe to be able to come forward and talk and get help. So that's one thing. And then I think whether it's a sermon series or a seminar series or a Saturday morning men's or women's prayer breakfast, I think, you know, devoting time, you know, in the church to talking about sexual purity and so forth. I mean, I think that's something that all churches need to do. And the greatest results I've seen is when a pastor is willing to have dedicated events, whether it's, like I said, a men's prayer breakfast or a sermon series. I mean, those kind of things really produce results. As long as that church also has made some provisions for support groups and so forth to be formed within the church so that men who are, in fact, struggling can, you know, get regular help.
One pastor friend of mine says those kind of experiences, those kind of faith stories, as you're calling them, he calls that giving the gift of going second, where a person is up in front and says, I'm going to spill my guts. And now that's my gift to you, because now you don't need to feel afraid to spill your guts. You don't need to feel afraid to come clean with what you have. And for those that are really gripped in this, what would be some of the resources you guys have available over at Faithful and True?
If you're really lost in the grip of addiction, I think one of the things that I've always said is that, bottom line, you should be able to go and talk to your pastor. Your pastor should be aware of therapists, Christian counselors in your area that could meet with you and more or less do an assessment and say, you know, this is in fact really an addiction. There are those guys that are going to be able, you know, once they come forward and get honest, to simply go to a support type group, whether it's Celebrate Recovery or, you know, some Christ-centered group that's local, like a life group. And those guys can do that and they can get sober doing that. There are those guys that have, you know, some deeper spiritual and emotional issues that probably need to see a therapist. The thing that we're most excited about at Faithful and True is the workshop ministry that we do. And we have a workshop here that happens every month. It's a Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. We work with the guys all day long. We teach them our biblical model, or we set up and have them do some writing and other kinds of exercises to get them in touch with you know, where this came from in their life and that kind of thing. We talk about how to take every thought captive and make it obedient to Christ. And, you know, we talk about fantasies and how to control that. And so it's just really a transforming type of experience for the average guy that comes to our workshop. We have workshops for wives, and then we have workshops for couples. I think what Faithful and True Ministries would like to be able to teach the world is that marriages can not only survive infidelity, but marriages can thrive after infidelity, and that there's hundreds of examples of couples that have walked through this and built a new relationship.
You have been listening to our interview with Dr. Mark Laser. For more information about Faithful and True's counseling groups, workshops, and articles, visit faithfulandtrueministries.com. To hear more of our podcasts, visit us on iTunes or the Covenant Eyes blog, Breaking Free, at covenanteyes.com/blog.